N.T. Wright, chapter, what was it, 3? Give us our daily bread. Thoughts, reflections. I know it's 7 a.m. I'll give you a couple minutes to warm up. Yes?
I know that we've always, like, at least I've always been told that you should just go to God and, like, hi, can I have $20? Thanks, bye. But then, like, we almost say, like, we should better God up first. Like, So I feel like there are two ends to that. But I've always been told that, and it's just hard to, like, apply, especially when, like, they talk about the stream of consciousness and how you just see these things that, like, boil over in your life. And so it really kind of, like, helped my perspective on that, about how you need to, like, have a relationship with God and then take things through that relationship.
Yeah, to give us our daily bread, that is a very intimate request. Because as the father of my children, it is my responsibility to make sure they get their daily bread. And there is an intimate reliance that they have on me to do that. And if I don't, they're not ready for school. They're not, I mean, they, you know, obviously there are all the complications that come with that. So asking God for something as basic and provisional as my daily bread, it's describing, you are assuming on some level a deep intimacy with Him. An intimacy, frankly, that is unparalleled relationally on this world. I guess in some sense you could say that I rely on Ozark for my daily bread. You could argue that. But there isn't really that intimacy in that sense. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? There is this, you are my father, I am your child, and if you don't feed me, I don't know what will happen. I don't have any other options. And I'm assuming that not only are you a father that wants to take care of me, but that you're a good father and that you will. I mean, that's one of the things. 2 summers ago, it's a basic realization, but for me, it was a pretty monumental one. And it was just this. He is a good father. That's just real important for us to keep in mind. He's a good father. He's a good dad. I absolutely despise when people say things like, man, I just can't stand the Middle East and all this stuff. Well, go better watch what I'm saying. God's going to send me there. Like, what kind of God is that? He's just like, what do you not like? Okay, I'm gonna burn you with it. Like, what? That's not a good father. I'm not saying that He won't ask you to do things difficult. But if you think He's so sadistic that whatever it is you don't like, if you don't say it out loud, then He won't call you there. That's just a weird picture of God. That's not Him. He's a good father. Now, He may challenge you to be something different than what it is, or even say, I know what you want, but ultimately this is what's best for you. But it's that last phrase that's important to insert into the equation. It's not just, I know it's what you want, but you don't always get what you want. That's not how He is. He's saying, listen, I know this may not be what you're desiring, but this is what's best for you. Trust me, I'm a good father. I'm a good father. Does that make sense? Man, as we've been talking about this, it's very important to have a very clear, even in the language that you speak flippantly, it's very important to have a very crystal clear image of who God is and to reflect that in your speech, because that is ultimately what you're going to be reflecting. And so if you have an obscure or a vindictive God that is the image that you see or that you speak of, ultimately that's what you will reflect. So it's pretty important, even down to the way in which you talk about Him or to talk about Him sending you, that you use the right grammar. And it's not just a slip of the tongue. It is a discipline of the tongue to make sure it is in line with ultimately what is revealed about Him. Okay? Does that make sense? He's a good dad. He really is. Other thoughts? Nothing. One thought. It was a good one though, Faith. It was a good one.
How about the comment you made when you quoted that prayer about how, like, all desires are laid bare before God, and that, like, you can tell a lot about a person's spiritual health by whether they see that as a threat or they see that as a promise.
Yeah. How did the rest of you respond to that? I've seen nods, but explain your nods. It's a really important distinction. So let's dialogue about it for a moment. Go.
All right, there's been times in my life, both in high school and after high school being married, that I find very threatening to God, my attitudes and the intentions of why I do things. Mm-hmm. And I didn't find it comforting that he knew what I was doing or why I was doing it. Which is good now, because I've had to learn that, my intentions matter to him as much as any action I do. Mm. And therefore, you end up talking about both of those, not just what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's one of those things where, again, it reminds me of the Paul passage. Imitate me as I imitate Christ. And it's like, man, some of you don't want to say that. And that's a problem. It's not an arrogant thing to say. It's, no, I honestly believe if you walked in the footsteps I'm walking, it would end the same place I'm going to end at. And that's Jesus. And if you're like, oh, don't follow me, don't imitate me. Like, well, then where are you headed? Who are you walking towards then? I don't understand. Ultimately, if your desires and your intentions are laid bare, it should lead to Jesus. It should not be an embarrassing thing that God knows them. Even the bad ones. You hear that, right? It's not because you should be perfect as your heavenly Father. We're getting there. God says we're getting there. Like, Martin Luther had a major problem with this. He took that so seriously that finally, and he would go to confession for hours at a time. And then even his motivation of coming to confession, he had to confess because he felt like it was selfish. And finally the confessor's like, you're not allowed to come anymore. You've confessed to the point where you're done confessing for at least 2 weeks. His punishment was no confession. He gets set in time out. You're confessing too much. You're out of control. Why? Because this over-confession, this over-nervousness was in a sense communicating how he was viewing God. This evil, vindictive God, that if he finds any desire, any intent that is misguided or even selfish, he's like, I'm this close to zapping you. Like, that's not who he is. He's a good dad. It's one of those things where, man, my kids, whoa, we had a rough night last night. Pugh. My goodness, we had our home group, and we have these amazing babysitters that watch our kids, and we love them, and they genuinely love our kids. Our kids collectively were so bad. These two babysitters that have been with us for like 3 years were almost in tears. So it was not a good night in the Wood household after home group. Because I had to sit down, and honestly, my frustration was, this isn't who you are. In the moment, though, was I ready to crucify him? No! Because we're working on this. My two boys are 9 and 5. Granted, I'm disappointed with the way they're acting, but I can't expect them to act like an 18-year-old. Well, I guess on some levels that could be frightening too, but it depends on the 18-year-old. Depends on the kid. Does it not? But my goodness, you have a gracious father, a patient father. And he's one that even whenever he understands your intentions and motivations and he finds them misguided, it doesn't mean he's immediately desiring to squash you like a bug. That's just not who he is. You can be honest with, and that's where I told my kids this. I said, my frustration point with you is up here. You tell me the truth, it lowers. You don't, it heightens. I was like, so just tell me the truth. Is that you're gonna be disciplined. Like, you are. I'm letting you know that right now. But bottom line is, this could get worse for you, and you don't want it to get worse. And on some level, but there is a graciousness and there is a restraint in that. It's not me just running in there, flying off the handle and swinging, and whatever I hit's good enough for me. That's not our God. That's not who I am, and that's not who ultimately I should be reflecting. Does that make sense? So this idea of, if my intentions are laid bare, I better hide what I really want in ministry. I better hide what my real motivations are. Well, yeah, the motivations are a problem, but you can't hide them. And ultimately, even when they're laid bare, the Spirit says, let's work on that. Let's mold that. Let's transform that. Other thoughts, reflections? Yeah, go ahead.
I loved how he ended the chapter, saying, after all, we ourselves are only at Jesus' table because he made a habit of celebrating parties with all the wrong people. Isn't it time we started to copy him? And I just love how he shows how Jesus did that for us, and how we need to do that.
Absolutely.
So that's awesome.
No, yeah, you're exactly right. And that phrase right there is at the very heart of what we're even talking about in here. Number one, he flat out says, what did Jesus do? So then what should you be doing? Okay, let's do that. Yeah. It's a very simple equation, but it's incredible how difficult it is and how widely neglected it is. Very simple equation. Bottom line is this. I mean, anybody ultimately could have come up with what the point of this class is. Problem is we don't, and that's what's weird about all this. It's that we don't. But yeah. Matter of fact, and even the he provides the, you know, the way in which we can even sit down, and he eats it with all the wrong people. And it's like, but you have to remember, you're one of the wrong people that he has still chosen to sit down with. You are one of those people. Does that make sense? Ah, N.T. Wright. Small book. Very powerful, though. Powerful book. Then again, it's on the Lord's Prayer, and we could talk about the theology behind that. Okay, where have we been, and where are we headed? Where have we been? Go. What have we talked about? Let's summarize so far, the entire class, because we're about ready to move into a new phase. Defining biblical justice. What is a short definition at this point of biblical justice? Imitating Christ. That's exactly what Josiah just brought up. Imitating Christ. What else? What have we talked about so far? Flip through your notes. See different phrases that stick out. Then yell them.
The idol of salvation.
The idol of salvation. Which is basically pointing towards the concept that a lot of times our actions, even our theology, is driven by what gets us into heaven. The way in which we even deliberate ethical choices is damnation, salvation based, as opposed to transformation based. And that's a problem. We'll talk. We are going to. I just want to give you, remind you of a commercial I've been given early on. We will talk very specifically about how salvation plays into this whole thing. We will have a whole, at least half a lecture, if not more, on just the piece of salvation and why it is so important. So don't hear me completely destroying the concept of salvation. It's just the idol we've created I'm not happy with. Okay? Good. Other stuff.
The phrase that I like is, stop asking what is right, but who will I become?
Yes, the concept of becoming versus right and wrong. Who will I become whenever I engage in this action? And ultimately, if our goal is to be transformed to the likeness of Christ, that should dictate a lot of what you do. Good, good, good. Other stuff? Yes, the last couple of class periods we've been asking the question, why Jesus? Paul takes it back to Romans 15, takes it back to dietary laws, says even down to what you eat should be dictated by Jesus. And we ask the question, why? You know, why and not the Old Testament? It's a lot more. It's older. And the answer is twofold. Number one, Jesus is the revelation of the divine. He exegetes the Father. He doesn't just pull back a veil and make visible what is invisible. He actually explains fully who God is, the very identity of God, which then we then talked about. As a result, Jesus also exegetes the Old Testament most clearly. Man, DeFazio and I were wrestling through a couple of different things yesterday, like with the different quotations in the New Testament. And it's fascinating because sometimes there's a quotation in the New Testament and you can tell they have the whole chapter in mind. So, Psalm 22, whenever Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? I argue that the entire Psalm's in view. And it's not about God abandoning him. It's actually about God, in spite of what everybody can see, God actually is still being proved faithful. And you can tell even by the way in which the casting of lots for the clothing, the surrounding by dogs, the things that at the cross they're launching out and lashing out at Jesus with, almost identical phrases found in Psalm 22 throughout the whole Psalm. And so you stop and go, clearly, when Jesus is quoting that, he has the whole psalm in mind. And then there's other passages where you're going, there is no way. The only thing that parallels Jesus is that one phrase. I don't understand how any of the rest of the chapter can make sense. So, Acts chapter 1, whenever they replace Judas with Matthias, and the passage that he quotes there, man, we sat there and for like 15 minutes, him and I both were like, can you come up with anything that parallels the life of Jesus from this context? Anything? You know, because as it is written, he must be replaced with another. And we read it, we're going, no. Honestly, it was just that phrase. Just the phrase. And yet for them, they're going, ah, but that one phrase makes most sense in the life of Christ and what he has ultimately given us. It makes most sense here. Why? All the Old Testament is exegeted by Jesus. Even down to the phrases that at some point you thought were meaningless now become meaningful in Jesus. Fascinating. The second answer, though, is that why Jesus? Well, he is also the clearest revelation of true humanity. He is the one that reflects the divine, and he shows us what true humanity is to look like. We talked about how Matthew chapter 5, verse 48 is not hyperbole. But be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect is a celebration of Genesis 1, 26 and 27, the fact you have been created in the image of God. And he is ultimately trying to reveal to us what true humanity even looks like. And so we ended last class talking about the definition of true humanity given by the world. The definitions of true humanity given by the world usually falls into one of five categories, although there could be more. Freedom, doing whatever you want, whenever you want, without any consequences. Two, things should come easy. Convenience, lack of effort. Three, success is found in dominance, power, money, and beauty. Four, happiness is attainable if you are just true to yourself or you just follow your heart. Then number five, you are who you are. You were just made this way. There's no hope for transformation. And Jesus comes in and he begins to challenge with counterclaims these definitions of true humanity. And we talked about how even in the culture, even though they give us these definitions of true humanity, you can tell that they are absolutely lost and have no idea who their identity is. So we talked about the obsession of the I, iPods, iPads, but we can't define what that is. And Jesus comes and he says, I'm not just showing you the image of the invisible God. I'm showing you what the image of the invisible God reflected in true humanity looks like when it's lived out. In other words, Jesus did come to save and restore this relationship. But he didn't just say, the only thing I have will be able to be experienced in the distant future. He says, actually, I've come to restore life now. I've come to give you, matter of fact, this is what he says in John 8:31. If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Well, when will I be set free, Jesus? When does the truth set you free? Now? Or whenever you die? I'm not using that last part metaphorically. When does the truth set you free? Now or in the future whenever you cease to breathe? And Jesus would say, yes. A lot of times when we think of liberation or whenever we think of freedom in Christ, we think of something ultimately that will happen at a second coming or whenever we die. But it doesn't seem to, in his mind, to think that it has to wait until then. John 10:10, he says, no, I have come that you may have life and have it to the full. When? Now! Oh, silly Jesus. You just say things that ultimately you know are unrealistic. You're an idealist. You remind me of teenagers. You're just idealistic. It's interesting because I was overhearing a conversation down in the MPB. This probably was like 3 or 4 years ago, and I've never forgot it. John Weiss had spoken at preaching and teaching. And he was down front, and you know, it's typical of somebody gets done speaking on a stage, people usually surround him and they just want to like shake his hand. Usually it's freshmen, you know, but not none of you guys, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. But he's down there, and they're all surrounding him, they're talking to him, and I was just honestly just standing off to the side, talking to some other people, and I heard this student come up and ask a question I wanted to hear the answer to. He looked at John and he said, as a freshman, what is the one piece of advice that you would give me? One piece of advice. And I'm sitting there thinking in my mind, I was like, what would I say? How would I answer that? I was like, you know, study really hard. I'm like, yeah, maybe, you know, hold on to Jesus. That sounds really spiritual. You know, I had a whole list of my own. And John looked at the freshman and he said, never lose your idealism. And I was like, wait a minute, what? What kind of advice is that? Sounds new agey. Come on, John. And then it's really grabbed a hold of me over the past couple years the more I've thought about it. One of the biggest problems in our churches is we're just not idealistic enough. We just don't speak about things that are ridiculous enough. We shoot too low. We're too realistic at times. I mean, we're so foolish to think that the church's prayers and the church's efforts on the ground can actually stop and transform what's happening in Syria. No, be realistic. Church can't do that. Wait a minute, what? I think we need a strong dose of idealism. That my goodness, we can shoot so big and we should dream so large that we truly, honestly, idiotically believe that we can change the world through the cross of Jesus Christ. Actually transform the world. Never lose your idealism. It's one of the things that you will be looked down upon by older people that have lost their idealism. Saying, oh, come on, be more realistic. Why? Why not do things that are so ridiculous that if the Holy Spirit's not in it, it'll fall apart? Why not do that? Why is it that the best thing we can do is dream up another program that'll get another 15 people that already go to 15 other programs inside of it? Why is that the best that we can dream up? Well, why don't we do stuff that's so stupid that the world looks at it and says, that's going to fail. And when it doesn't, the world says, how did that not fail? Well, it's because we're idealistic enough to believe that we have a good Father that has a powerful Holy Spirit that can actually accomplish more than what it is that we think we can accomplish. Maybe sometimes what I'm in a sense saying is all the strategies that you learn sometimes of church development and things of that nature, sometimes you need to just throw them to the wind. Not all the time. I'm not saying they're worthless. But what I'm saying, if those constrain you and don't liberate you, that's a problem. Does that make sense? This is not a call for foolishness completely. But it is a call for idealism, and there's a difference. And so to this day, Southland continues to do just ridiculous things. Ridiculous things. Like taking a mall in the middle of one of the more impoverished areas and turn it into not only a church plant, but also turn it into a homeless shelter in the back and a food pantry in one of the worst parts of Lexington. Matter of fact, they even caught some major backlash from the community by some people saying, oh, here's Southland expanding their empire. Well, it's not totally a false accusation if you understand the empire meaning kingdom of God. Does that make sense? All that to say, whenever Jesus says, I've come to give you life and life to the fullest, I think he was being a bit idealistic, but through him it's quite realistic. He can give it to you now. You can experience life to the fullest now. Jesus comes and he says, freedom is not found in doing whatever you want, whenever you want. It's found in being a slave to Christ. Success is not found in dominance, power, money, or beauty. It's found in being a servant whenever people would expect you to serve. Jesus says, love is not found in the shape of a bed or a relationship or a sexual orientation. It's found in the cross. Jesus says, purpose is found in our mission and identity is found in him because he is the image of the invisible God that reflects what true humanity can look like. That's why Jesus. So now let me ask this question. Then where's the disconnect? What's the problem? The problem is interestingly shown to us not just by Christian polls, but non-Christian polls. 2007, David Kinnaman, book Unchristian. Heard of it? Fascinatingly frightening results of a poll to non-Christians asking, what are Christians known for? What are Christians characterized? Top three answers. We're not. Sacrificial love, friend of sinners, and sacrificial service. Those were not the top three answers. What Christians are known for is number one, anti-homosexual. Number two, judgmental. And number three, hypocritical. Granted, that was 2007. So my response would be, okay, so then what's changed? What are we known for now? Maybe we could throw in there, you know, incredible lovers of guns. Maybe we could throw that in there. Because we are gaining that reputation quite rapidly as well. So the question would be, what has changed? Or has it really changed? Has much changed? Have we still earned that reputation with our actions? Yeah, we have. Really have. I in a sermon once, and this was one of the sermons where I've had people walk out at certain points in my sermons throughout my time preaching. This was one, and it happened about 4 years ago, and I asked the question, or I said the statement. I said, one of the problems is that the closest many of you ever get to a homosexual is whenever you're voting against them in a ballot, or you're boycotting an institution that's donated to a homosexual cause. That's as close as you ever get to them. That's the problem. And then this couple got up and walked out. And I almost said, that's my point. But I was like, no, I can't do that. But you see the problem. I mean, honestly, a lot of the people, it reminds me very of the Samaritan type attitude with the disciples. You want us to call down fire on them? Wipe them out? God hates them anyway. How do I know? Westboro Baptist told me so. That's how I know. No. Where would Jesus be? Where would he be? I'm just curious. How do you think he would interact with the homosexual community? Probably the same way that he reacted with the other sinners that he was walking around. Probably hang out with them, get to know them and love them into moments of transformation. See, we have a much different tactic than Jesus in our evangelistic tactics. We beat people to moments of transformation. Jesus loved them and allowed them to beat him. Much different. As a matter of fact, I'm wrestling through the book of Revelation on a different level from a different perspective right now. And this is the conclusion I've come to over the past year or so is we're not really, our church in America is not as close to Laodicea as we once were. We still are. Laodicea is the church that had so much wealth that they didn't need God, Revelation 3. So, but honestly, we're closer to Ephesus in Revelation 2. Ephesus, why Jesus gets rowdy with them and says, I'm about to remove your lampstand, is because they were sacrificing people on the altar of truth. They knew the truth of Jesus Christ, and they were murdering people with it. And Jesus says, I'm sorry, you've forgotten your first love. Do you remember the heights from which you had fallen before you met me? Do you remember that? And yet you're using that grace that lifts you up to kill people? I'm sorry, I'm just about ready to remove your lampstand. Jesus takes the love aspect so seriously that even if you get the truth right, but you murder people with it, you can still be dead wrong. That's fascinating to me. That's haunting to me. What I'm saying with the homosexual community is, I'm not saying compromise what you know is true. But what I am saying is, you don't do it without love, you're way wronger than they are. You are way more wrong. For what they should ultimately do, and this has happened recently, I know a student that is not a homosexual, and yet they were voted as the president of the LGBT in a local university. Let that sink in a moment. Why? Because that person loved everyone in there so much that they were like, we even want you to be our president, even though you're not LGBT or T. You're not any of them, but we want you to help lead us. There's something interesting about that. There's something Christ-like about that. Where even people look at him and say, you're so far, you're just not like me. And yet there's something about you, I need to be around you. Oh, that the church were known for that. Oh, that the church were known for that. That we would remember the heights from which we have fallen. But we're not known for that. We're known more for what we are against and what we hate than what we are for. And that's just the reality. We are known more about what we disagree with, about what policies we find to be damning, than we are about what it is that we are in support of. And there is a problem there. There is a disconnect. Yes?
I was just wondering what that guy's response was when they asked him to be president. What did he choose to do and have any reflect Jesus?
It was a she.
Oh, she.
And she accepted. And kept loving them. And was guided by wisdom. And a group of people around her that has kind of held her hand through the whole thing. And she's done amazing things with it. And she is still doing amazing things with it. I'm not going to say her name because some of you would even know her. But yeah, she's doing great stuff with it. It's amazing what love can do. And I know that that's such a remedial thing. But honestly, we just don't trust it enough. We really don't. We think, but what if they think I'm condoning it? Guess what? The Pharisees thought that of Jesus too, didn't they? Oh, he's eating with sinners and drunks. He must be a drunkard. Or he just loves them more than you do. Like, you're going to get accused of weird things whenever you love people radically. That's kind of the nature of the way the world is. Because if they don't understand it, they've got to put it in a box. That's what stereotypes are all about. Hey, are you saying then that you accept everything that, you know, homosexuals do? What does that have to do with anything at this moment? What I do know is this. Jesus loved them. And you know what? Whenever you rub shoulders with people that are not like the other people sitting in your pews, yes, some of the taint of their lifestyle will rub off on you. Not in the sense of you'll be doing it, but the reputation will also help smear yours. And it could even lead you to getting crucified. Is this making sense? Does it mean at any point then you need to compromise your holiness? No, listen. Did Jesus have to compromise his holiness? It's kind of like, you know, I talk to the immature Christians that are like, yeah, the reason why I cuss and I go out and drink is because I don't know any other way to ultimately, you know, reach out to this people group. Yes, that's exactly what Jesus needed to do. Whatever the fashion style was for the particular place he was in, he needed to change that, otherwise they wouldn't listen to him. And ultimately, if they were cussing, he needed to cuss too, because ultimately, I mean, how else are you going to talk to them? It's like I was talking to a student, he had a book of Satan in his room. I was like, why in the world do you have that? Well, you know, the people I'm reaching out to read it. I love your heart, go burn it. And we did. We actually took it down to the cross and crosses, and we burned it. And he was like, but you know, I'm just trying to study. What you need to study is how to love. Like, I mean, if you're looking for an apologetic on some level that you think, if you honestly think that intellectual apologetics is what converts people, number one, you haven't really talked to many people. Number two, that's just not the way that Christ always did. I'm not saying don't be prepared. But what I'm saying is ultimately Christ, well, take the Samaritan woman as an example. He's talking to her, and what does she do? She's throwing up objections, theological objections. Should we go and worship at Mount Gerizim, or should we? And Jesus says, yeah. You know what the real issue is? Well, why don't you just go get your husband and bring him back? It's a little too personal, Jesus. Yeah, love is always personal. Love always pierces through the intellectual smoke screens. I was talking to a student in my NT intro class, and he's been witnessing hard to one of his friends via Facebook or whatever. And he was like, I've answered every question. And he's like, what do I do now? I say, you actually realize what the questions are hiding. I said, the guy's hiding a true hurt, a true pain. You got to figure out what that is. Most of the time, the intellectual objections are just so that you never get to the true heart of the issue. It's a propaganda tool. It's something that the media uses all the time. If I can get you to focus on this, no one's focusing on what it really is, the true issue down here. And that's what people do with their questions. 9 times out of 10. I was meeting with a student a couple years ago, and we met every Monday for 3 hours at a time for like 5 consecutive Mondays. And it was just him launching questions. And every Monday, he'd leave. He'd be like, well, you answered them all. And he'd leave. Finally, on like the fourth or fifth one, I was like, hold on. So I'm not meeting with you anymore. He's like, why? What's wrong? I said, unless you want to talk about something other than your intellectual questions. But this is what's holding me back from being truly a follower of Jesus. No, it's not. I said, because this is what I'm noticing. Every time I answer all of your 3 hours of questions, you've got 3 hours more the next week. And it's never going to stop. And I was like, you until you realize what the true issue is, these conversations are meaningless. He said, well, what's the true issue? I said, do you want me to be honest? He said, yeah. I said, you reject God because your mom was diagnosed with MS whenever you were 8. That's why you're denying God. Because if you accepted that God existed, you'd have to deal with the pain and the questions of why my mom. And you don't want to deal with that pain. I said, is that wrong? He said, no, you're right. I said, then there's really no reason to keep talking about this. Well, what should I do? He was a student at Ozark at the time. What should I do? I said, finish out the semester so that your transcripts don't get messed up. And then, you either dive into Jesus or you just dive into what it is you're wanting to do. And after 10 years, we'll come back and compare notes. And he dropped out at semester. Does it break my heart? No question. But ultimately, until people want to deal with the true issues, your answering of apologetic questions is just sending, you're buying into the circle. I'm not saying don't have an answer. What I'm saying is answer them to the point where you can finally say, okay, let's talk about real stuff. Fact of the matter is you're wounded because your dad left when you were 2. You've never really recovered from that. You're broken because you were molested when you were 7. You've never really dealt with that. You're just absolutely confused of relationally how to trust anybody because your parents divorced whenever you were 9. Let's deal with that. That's where 90% of objections come from. It's just the reality. And yet we spin it intellectually so we can hide from the pain of the true pain that Jesus wants to heal. And that's why you don't find Jesus a lot of times engaging completely with people's intellectual or theological objections. He goes to the heart of it. Because ultimately he says, but that's what I want to heal. Because if I heal this, all of this starts to take care of itself. This is the true problem. And if I keep, it's kind of like a doctor. You come in and you have appendicitis. You need a surgery. But he keeps just giving you painkillers and all the different things to just treat the symptoms. Sorry, until you have the surgery, you're not going to get better and you probably will even die. And that's the same issue when you're dealing with people. They want you, you think you're going to be focusing so much on the symptoms, you're going to miss the surgery they really need. And Jesus just wouldn't be fooled by that. He went right to the heart of it. No, I want to give you life and life to the fullest, but the thing we have to deal with is bring back your husband. I don't have a husband. You're right. The five previous ones you were living with are no longer your husband. The one you're currently living with isn't your husband either. That is right. And that's the issue, isn't it? And how does that end? How does that result? How does that interaction with Jesus, Samaritan woman end? Do you remember? She runs back to town screaming, "The Messiah could be here!" She turns into an evangelist. Why? Because he healed the true part that was broken. He healed the true part that was broken. All sin, even your sin, is connected to woundedness. It's connected to brokenness. Focus on the heart of it, it'll start affecting the sin. Only focus on the sin, never get to the heart of it, you'll always struggle with sin. You see the issue? Is this making sense? Who are you becoming? Is really what's driving this entire conversation. Not what is right and what is wrong or what is intellectually acceptable when it comes to belief or non-belief in God. The problem is not just in the non-Christian poll, but the problem is also evident in a Christian poll that startled me. My Christian life class always began with really the same two lectures, or really the same. The very first time I taught it, I did it in the same one, and it freaked me out. First thing I did is I asked the class, I said, what characterizes the Christian life? And they didn't give me the un-Christian answers. I said, what are Christians known for? And a lot of times it falls into one of two categories of the answers I would get. The first time I asked this question, it was very concrete. It was stuff like, well, Christians, you know, what are they known for? What characterize them? They fast. They're people that pray. They do devotions. Usually this is kind of the area people go, or people will get so abstract it almost means nothing. You know, so like, you know, Christians, they love, okay. You know, or, you know, Christians, they have faith, okay. Usually it's one of two extremes. Either complete abstraction that it means absolutely nothing, or when they get tangible, this is the area they go. And honestly, that didn't shock me, because that's what I was told all throughout growing up. That's what was beat into my mind. I mean, I tell people all the time, you know, my story is I was basically born in a pew. I mean, I've always been in the church. And I feel like that on my heart, it was tattooed this list. This is what you do whenever you're a Christian. You make sure you're praying and doing your devotions every morning and you're fasting and you're blah, 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 blah. Like, that's just what you do. That's what we're known for. Like, that's what characterizes the Christian life. I almost was shocked by the next time. The next thing I did is I erased the board. I said, okay, what was Jesus known for? What was Jesus characterized by? And their answers were quite predictable as well. You know, Jesus was a friend of sinners. Jesus was a healer. Jesus was known for his self-sacrificial love. Or people would even just summarize that with the cross. He's known for the cross. They started making this interesting list. He was a preacher. He was a teacher. And that didn't shock me either. Because whether you're talking to Christians or non-Christians, even today, that's what Jesus is known for. Even today. So Gandhi can stop and he can say, oh no, I actually really love the teachings of Jesus. It's just the Christians I have a problem with. But how did Gandhi know Jesus? Like this. Even in the ancient world, that's what Jesus was known for. Oh, he was known for eating meals with sinners. That was part of the problem with the Pharisees and Sadducees. So this didn't shock me. What shocked me was this. We had both lists on the board, and a question went through my mind randomly. And the question was, why are the two lists different? I mean, isn't that weird? I was like, no, something's not right. If we are Christians, his very name is in my name, then why do we look so different from Christ? Why are we categorically characterized as something completely different than Him, even when we characterize ourselves? We don't say, what are Christians known for? Man, we're known for eating with sinners. We're known for taking care of the poor. We're known for healing the sick. We're known for... It's not what we're known for. Not even amongst our own circles. That's not what we're known for. I sat there and thought, wow, that's a problem. There's a major disconnect that's happening. And what is it? Well, I think part of it is we're asking the wrong questions. And we're also, that in a sense, self-serve the wrong answers. 2002, Rick Warren publishes the book, The Purpose-Driven Life. Ever heard of it? Anybody? Yes? Yeah. My church did the big campaign. It was really good for our church. It was great. We started with small groups or life groups or home groups or cell groups, whatever you call them. But we started our group ministry, you know, and meeting in houses. In our small church, that was the very first time they'd ever done anything like that. And on the front of every one of the books, on all the DVDs, on all the banners, there was one question. Remember what it was? Drove the whole thing. What was it? Purpose-driven life. Question at the bottom is? Close. What on earth am I here for? What on earth am I here for? Two things about this phenomenon, the purpose-driven life, which sold millions and millions of copies, boggled my mind. Number one, it sold millions and millions of copies to Christians who apparently were so intrigued by the question because they didn't know the answer. What on earth am I here for? I have no idea. Let me read a book. I can figure it out. Let me read a book. Oh, sorry. The irony was too easy. Number two, what also boggled my mind was the answer to the question. The purpose-driven life basically was spiritual disciplines meted out over 40 days. It was good info, but basically it was this. That was the answer. What on earth am I here for? Well, this, this, and this, this, this. And we'll just call it worship. But this is what you're here for. 40 days. Just going through the disciplines. Now, let me be very clear. I'm not anti-spiritual disciplines at all. Actually, I'm very pro being spiritual disciplined. I'm very pro like praying. It's a big deal for me. I'm very much pro at times even fasting. I'm very pro, you know, even devotionals. I mean, I think those are good things. But my problem is the way in which they have taken over what characterizes who we are. Anything can become an idol that we worship. And the definition of an idol is whenever something oversteps its boundaries. And this list has overstepped its boundaries. It's just, it's playing a different role than what it's allowed to, or what Jesus asked it to, or what the New Testament thought it would. It's not supposed to be what characterizes the Christian life. Frankly, what I don't like about it is we have this mentality of if I do this list and I add water, bam, I'm close to Jesus. And that's just not true at all. One of the things that really bothered me with this list is whenever I was growing up and I would notice that the person I knew that even was teaching this type of a class on the spiritual disciplines in the church, a week or two after the class was over, we find out he was sleeping with the organist. What? Does that make any sense? I mean, if it's just do these things, add water, and I'm close to Jesus, how then could you be doing that as you're teaching this? Something was very strange to me. Or the same people that would practice fasting would also be the same people that were most consumed with materialism instead of the status quo. Oh, I pray and I fast, and they're talking to somebody that doesn't know if they're going to be able to eat that afternoon. And as they're doing it, they're flashing a ring that could have paid for that person's meals for the entire year. And I stop and go, there's a disconnect. Something's not adding up. Something's very strange to me. And maybe it's this. A lot of times the reason why we look for a list is so that we can control things. Why? Because if you can quantify Christianity or quantify a relationship with Christ, if you can say, do these five things, then you equal Jesus. Then ultimately, in some sense, we have control over the relationship. In some sense, we own it. Why? Well, my relationship is primarily dependent upon whether or not I'm doing these five things. And if I'm not, well, then I may not be as close as what I thought I would. Problem is, what if you are doing those things and you're still not growing closer to Jesus? We want to have a list because if we can quantify it, then we can also measure how close people are to Jesus that are sitting in the pews. Well, how often do you pray? Okay, let me ask a better question. How long? Is it over 10 minutes or not? What's your tithing like? If it's not 10%, you're obviously straight from the pits of hell. Oh, but it's only $4? What if that is 10% of the person you're talking to? You know, it's like the widow's mite. She didn't. She gave more than 10%. Well, we want people to give more than 10%. Sorry, you just said 10%. We try to figure out a way of gauging spirituality in a way in which is frankly unrealistic. It's like trying to gauge how much you love your wife by how many flowers you've bought her over the time in which you've been dating or married to her. It barely means anything. Now, don't get me wrong, flowers aren't bad. They have a place. But the place can't be gauging of the closeness of your relationship. Because that is something that frankly is beyond what anything science can give us. Let me end with this. We need to stop asking, what do we need to do in order to become close to Jesus? And we need to start asking, who are we? Our question of purpose betrays the problem. What on earth am I here for is something that intrigues us, because like the rest of the world, we don't know how to define the letter I. We don't know who we are. And when you don't know who you are, you don't know what to do. And then you become something that's totally different than what you were supposed to be. And we'll talk about how that flow begins or looks like tomorrow. Love you guys. See you in the morning.